Hello and welcome to Switch It, the podcast that's still wondering whether it's data or data. Fortunately, no one has tried to launch a new format of the game this week, so we can stick to known unknowns as we look ahead to the start of the international summer in England and, significantly, Ireland. I'm joined in the studio today by two men who know their Rumsfeldian. The always up for it, Andrew Miller, alongside salt and pepper sage, Mark Butcher. Trust everyone's well?
Ecstatic.
good. That's the sort of energy we need in the room. The county season is picking up steam. The tourists have arrived. There's even been some sunshine. We'll try not to pour cold water on things over the next half an hour. First up, it's a historic week for Irish cricket as the country hosts its first men's test match, Ireland v Pakistan, the biggest green-on-green matchup since the Holt got into a tangle with the delivery of frozen vegetables. Let's get the latest on the build-up from our team in Dublin.
Well, hello from Ireland. It's Jared and Mel here in Malahide, ahead of this historic moment, the first men's test involving Ireland. I think it's important to point that out. A lot of people have been saying it's the first test, but it is the second test for Ireland.
It's the first test that was actually sanctioned, to be fair. But if you want to be realistic, most of the early tests in cricket weren't sanctioned at the time anyway. So yeah. I'm more than happy to say that the Pakistan women and Irish women played each other. I just don't care about the semantics right at the moment.
Well, the reason that probably Jared doesn't care anymore is we've been working very hard for a few days, going around the countryside.
I've met a lot of old Irish men.
We have met a lot of old Irish men, which has actually been really wonderful.
It's been great.
It really has. We've been talking to people who were involved in the 1969 match where Ireland famously dismissed the West Indies for 25 at Sion Mills.
You haven't been able to find anyone from the 1904 game, unfortunately, where Ireland beat South Africa. Not yet, anyway. You never know.
We're thinking of having a séance later and talking to those people. But talking to those people, talking to the current players, talking to people who are involved in the game over here, I think we really need to just start by talking about what it means to them, because this is really huge. People are very emotional about this. So many people we've spoken to, Jared, have just said they never, ever thought this would happen.
No, I think Ed Joyce is about 38, 39, and he wouldn't have grown up thinking this was a possibility. He would have thought that if he played Test cricket, it would be for England. And, you know, even some of the younger guys in this team, when they were, you know, five or six and dreaming about playing Test cricket, they just wouldn't have probably been thinking about playing it for Ireland. I talked to Alan Lewis the other day and, you know, his big theory was, you know, maybe one day he might be able to qualify for Australia and play for Australia. You know, the ridiculous sorts of things that Irish cricketers had to think about that other cricketers don't. And, you know, you're talking about a game that is hundreds and hundreds of years old. I mean, we don't even know how far back cricket goes in Ireland, but it has incredible roots. And to be thinking that even 10 years ago that this was a pipe dream and that we're here now is just, it's a testament to how professional Ireland got and how good that golden generation was.
And when you talk about all the emotion that's coming in and the significance of it, one of the key difficulties or challenges that Graham Ford is going to face when this test starts is actually trying to just keep a bit of a lid, let them celebrate that, let them go through the cap presentations and everything else, but also try to keep it focused on the cricket. And I know we've been talking to some of the guys about how they do that and how they've built this test team up.
Yeah, when 2007, Warren Dootchum got the job, they had 1.5 employees when he came on board. So that's 11 years ago. And so Richard Holdsworth came in as a high performance director in 2011, and he basically had to build a professional cricket structure from scratch without much money, to be fair. They're still way more amateur than almost every county team, and a bunch of, you know, schools like Millfield in England would have far better facilities than all of Irish cricket combined. So what they have to do is build up their cricket. But then there's the simple emotion of it. So for someone like Ed Joyce, I mean, Ed Joyce has to go out and bat early after getting his Irish cap. I just don't know how he blocks that out of his mind. I mean, he's the sort of person that maybe could, but I'm not sure all the Irish players will be able to do that because it is such a big moment for them. And it's not so much a big moment for the country of Ireland because Ireland is not so much in love with cricket, but for these guys, a lot of them who are related to each other in some cases, but their fathers have played, their uncles played, their sisters play, you know, their mothers have played, and, you know, whole villages up in the parts of Northern Ireland, you know, have gone on to represent Ireland. For them, this is their family. So it's such a huge emotional impact. And then to grab your cap and go out and play, it's going to be tough. And, you know, I don't know whether there'll be anthems and everything, because obviously Ireland as a team is two different nations. But if there is an anthem, you know, it'd be interesting to see if they'll be able to contain themselves. A few past players and a few present players told me when they played the one day in Ireland, they had tears in their when they played the one day at Lords the first time in the long room, they all had tears in their eyes. This is a bigger moment than that.
Yeah. One thing you talk about them being amateur, one thing I hope they never lose is the way that they're just the nicest test team to deal with. To the point where we were standing there, it was freezing cold today. There was a little bit of rain coming down. There are a couple of journos there shivering away with some cameramen. And Niall O'Brien came out with bearing two trays with cups of tea that he'd just made for us all.
I missed that.
And I was just like, Joe Root's never, he's from Yorkshire and he's never brought me a cup of tea.
Yeah, well, yesterday they let us eat from their personal food stash, which I felt bad because obviously they're professional athletes and I devoured all the meats that they had on offer. But, you know, they are a different kind of team. And you haven't covered as much associate cricket as me, but there's a real associate vibe to this in that we're just kind of wandering around. We don't even have press accreditation. Players are coming up and saying hi to us. It's it doesn't feel like you know, a major sporting event. Now, coming tomorrow and the next day, when things start to kick off, maybe that will change. But at the moment, it just feels like we're one of the gang.
I know, it's lovely. Well, of course, it's not just one team playing this.
It is just one team. I'm not even going to mention Pakistan. Don't bring them up.
Oh, we have to bring up Pakistan because they are very... I like Pakistan.
So do I, but this is not their day, Mel.
But, well, how do they... Is that going to be something with them? When you look at this Pakistan side, they're a young team. They've got five new players in this squad. So generally, we're going to see quite a few debutantes.
We're going to see a lot of debutantes in this first test.
Oh my gosh. The cap presentation is going to go
it's
on.
It's an hour and a half.
3 hours, I think. But they are rebuilding after losing senior players. They're about to embark on this test tour of England after they finish this match. How, for them, do they, you know, they're just going to have to go business as usual. Let's just see what happens here. Or could the occasion maybe overcome them a little bit as well?
It will be interesting if they let the crowd get to them. The thing is, I've only been to one game at Malahide, but the crowd are really vocal here. And that's for a one day where usually crowds in Western cricket countries are so drunk they don't even notice the cricket. And Ireland got into that. If Ireland got on top early, and we know that this is a... we know that this is a new ball wicket. Most of the Irish players have said it should flatten out. But if they were to put, if Ireland were to put Pakistan in early with a young, inexperienced side, and they took a couple of early wickets, the pressure of the occasion and the crowd could get to them. So it would be a huge occasion. And realistically, Ireland have a really good chance. Whether they will do it or not, I don't know. But you could see how there's a possibility of an upset here.
Now, That's happening now. But beyond this match, where do you see the future of Ireland cricket? I mean, now they've got test status. They'll obviously be wanting to play more games, and that's going to be a huge thing to get enough fixtures. But beyond that, you need underneath this top level a base, of a support base, I guess, of players, of administration, of structure that can actually support the game at the top level. Do you think that's realistic that they can get that soon?
Cricket Ireland have come from literally nowhere to where they are in 11 years. They're building a centre of excellence, which is next to the Ireland Sports Academy or Sports, whatever it is. There's no doubt that they're trying to do all that. They've got a first-class structure, but they sent a junior team to Somerset recently, and the players looked around and were like, they've got 22 turf wickets. That's close to what we have in Dublin. So there's a long way to go. Warren Dutrum has done an incredible job. Cricket Ireland, who have 2 to 3 employees, but all seem to do 30 to 40 jobs, do an incredible job. Richard Holdsworth. The fact that they are where they are shows how good they can be, but there's a lot of obstacles that they need to overcome. I kind of back them because 11 years ago, no one would have thought they'd be here now. So I do back them, and I do think they have a lot of talent. They think their junior cricketers are as talented as anyone anywhere. They just think that the junior cricketers get stagnant in the Irish system. I think that they can work ways around that, and hopefully that they can build and become something special. But realistically, they know it's tough, and hopefully things go well for them.
Yeah, well, that's the future. But in the more immediate future anyway, we have got a test match to look forward to, an incredible occasion to look forward to, and we might even go and have a Guinness first.
I don't really drink Guinness, but I'll have a Jameson's. It's really cold.
It is cold. Let's go.
We'll be hearing plenty more from Mel, Jared and the team over the coming week. Butch, how excited are you for this this occasion? Predictions of what might pan out, apart from the likelihood of rain, of course?
Well, yeah, rain will probably be writ large over the 5 days. It's a great occasion, absolutely huge occasion for Irish cricket, for the 11 players who take the field, for all of those who sort of went before them in the hope that one day that this would happen, and that includes administrators and coaches and various other people who have put their heart and soul into making this happen for Irish cricket. There is a slight caveat in it for me, in that in becoming now a fully fledged Test Match nation, the route to acquiring and producing players, you know, ad infinitum for the rest of their time, now looks extremely difficult. They've got the three counties or the three provinces that will play the game professionally. Players who have up until this point been involved with counties, obviously people like Tim Murta and Boyd Rankin and Ed Joyce, etc., will carry on being able to play their cricket in England, but the young fellas will not. They will not be able to play. Well, they will if they're good enough and they can be signed as overseas players, but overseas player status is going to be the problem for them. I am struggling to see how a very, very small nation with an even smaller percentage of that population that plays cricket is going to be able to maintain the production of the necessary quality of players in order to be, in order to be, how do you say it, competitive in Test Match cricket. So this could be this is going to be a great moment. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But goodness me, they've got their work cut out for them in the future if it's going to be anything other than, a very short-lived celebration.
It wouldn't be first-class cricket if we weren't immediately sounding sort of the doom and gloom now, would it? But Miller, the 11th Test Nation, it's been a long time coming, I suppose. But although Ireland are getting there ahead of schedule, having set out this roadmap to Test status by 2020.
Well, indeed, and they are ahead of schedule, but kind of, as Butch says, they're kind of 11 years behind schedule in many ways, because so much was achieved by the team that basically broke through at the 2007 World Cup. Against Pakistan, funnily enough, you know, that famous win in Sabina Park, it really set up everything. That was a transformative moment for Irish cricket, and they have done so well to just keep pushing the agenda so hard and so firmly against, let's face it, pretty obstinate ICC, who weren't particularly interested in expanding their remit, as we've seen with the state of the World Cup. But essentially pretty much the same squad that took the field in 2007, give or take a few obvious additions over the course of 11 years, are the ones who are now going to take the field for this first Test match. So, you know, you've got the likes of Boyd Rankin and the O'Briens and Porterfield. These guys have been around the block for Irish cricket. You do, as Butch says, you do worry about where this next generation is going to come from. But on the flip side, let's face it, this is an extraordinary moment for them. The celebrations that are going to take place at Malahide over the coming week are something that, well, we need to see them to believe them, really. I mean, you know, this is we remember what happened when in 1994 World Cup, when the Irish became the toast of that football tournament, and obviously the rugby, they've long been punched above their weight and, you know, genuine World Cup contenders for in there.
We won't mention the Grand Slam.
Won't mention the Grand Slam, but the point is we've suddenly got cricket elevated to the same tier as rugby and football. That has got to be a sign that, you know, if you're judging by the state that those two sports and a small country have managed to extend their reach and their worth beyond perhaps what you might expect. So good luck to them. It's not going to be easy,
absolutely.
But it's got to be. You've got to start somewhere, and they've done so much in the last 11 years that you've got to believe that they can push on through.
A green run at Malahide. Tim Murtagh takes 12 wickets on Test match debut at 36. That's what I'm looking for.
well, you know, that would certainly be memorable.
Please don't anybody get me wrong in sort of saying, you know, that they're not good enough and they shouldn't be allowed. I mean, you know, they can compete for sure. How long that would be the case is a question. I mean, you only have to look at England, the country that invented the game of cricket with 18 counties and all the people that play the game recreationally and otherwise up and down the length and breadth of the land, and we're in Test match cricket we're fifth with all of the fifth best in the world with all of the investment that goes on there, not to mention the 90s and whatever happened before then. You know, it's even with all of the infrastructure you could possibly wish for, you know, it's very, 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 very difficult, you know, to be classed as a success in Test match cricket, because it's an incredibly difficult game, and so therefore, you know, Ireland really have a very, very stiff task in front of them, given their situation.
I mean, there are, you mentioned the squad and sort of that nucleus of players that have been around for quite a while, but there are some tremendous storylines within that. Boyd Rankin set to become, I think, the 15th player to play Tests for two different countries. You've got the O'Brien brothers, and Ed Joyce is going to join his brother, his sister, Isabel, in becoming a Test cricketer. Ireland's women having played a Test as far back ago as 2000. So certainly one for the Joyce family to celebrate.
Absolutely. Rejoice.
Rejoice, oh, very good. But no, I mean,
we won't get into James Joyce and the cricketing.
Rankin and Joyce, Jared, in particular, though. I mean, these guys who are going to be dual internationals, you know, Joyce and Rankin's England careers weren't the greatest. I mean, Joyce obviously had his moments in way back in 2006, but Rankin is the one who obviously came onto the scene for that dismal Sydney Test back in 2014. Came into the match injured, bowled like a drain, was never seen again. Assumed that was the end of his road, and now suddenly here he is getting a chance for redemption. It's a great tale. He's a bowler who, obviously, as we mentioned, he was one of the integral parts of Ireland's rise in white ball cricket. Essentially, it's a great chance for him to sort of put a seal on what's, you know, when you look back in the annals in years to come, you'll look at this squad of players and think there were one or two who really have done something transformative for Irish cricket, and he has got a real chance to cement his status among that elite band.
Well, England will be hoping that Ireland can pinpoint a weakness or two ahead of their two-test series with Pakistan, which starts on May the 24th. Ed Smith will be picking his first England squad over the weekend, and rather like Donald Trump in Iran, the dilemma is whether to stick or twist. How much freedom does he have, Miller, do you think, with this first squad?
I think he's got, kind of as we said last week, I think he's got a lot of freedom insofar as England are pretty woeful at the moment. They're if ever you've got a Test squad that deserves a shake up, it's the England team that hasn't won abroad for 13 Tests, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, where do you begin? Alistair Cook's is kind of the obvious sort of golden boy who's a bit tarnished at the moment. Do you make a big statement and say, look, Alistair, your form does not merit selection here. Tell him to take leave for the first time in 150 Tests. I mean, you know, that would be the ultimate big statement that would be justified. I can't see him going down that route. And if he's not going down that route, how does he justify other big statement selections? I don't know. I think there are arguments both ways.
On the subject of those that sort of the axe might be hovering over and who Ed Smith might be inking in to replace them, there seem to be, Butch, probably seven definites. If you're going to assume Alistair Cook retains favour, obviously Joe Root will be in the side. David Milan had a good winter. Ben Stokes will be back from the IPL.
Well,
yep. You've got Johnny Bairstow, Stuart Broad and James Anderson. Do you think that's going to be the core of this selection as well? And then fill
it
in the blanks.
It absolutely has to be. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of... the gleeful sounds that when you know, or chatterings on Twitter and social media and stuff when Cook and Root both go for naught in their first innings in Canterbury, just don't worry about it. It's absolutely irrelevant. They will be playing in that first Test match, no matter how many or how few runs they score between now and then. As will James Anderson. What did he got? He got a pair, didn't he? Or got naught and ended up taking none for or whatever for Lancashire. But don't, you know, it doesn't make any difference.
But did you see his haircut?
They will be playing. It was extraordinary. Yes, so sick boy from train spotting was my... and Johnny Lee Miller's not a bad looking fella, so I suppose he won't mind that too much.
That's more complimentary
It's Vince, it's Stoneman. Both of whom have had a very quiet time in the opening rounds of the
county championship. Yeah, I think 150 between them so far.
Yeah, it is Chris Wokes, who's obviously still over in India on the IPL, so it's very unlikely that his name will appear for that first Test match squad. Mark Wood is obviously coming back, so you know there's a possibility there. And then it's whether or not Ed Smith decides to take this opportunity to kind of to start again. To be a new broom and go, okay, well, Joe Clark's just made 150 against Surrey. Everyone's been talking him up for the last year and a half. You know, throw another young batsman into the middle order against what will be a fabulous bowling attack from Pakistan. Or do you stick with the guys that kind of did okay over the back end of the winter? I mean, for Vince and Stoneman in particular, it wasn't disastrous. They weren't disastrous tours. They weren't good, but it wasn't a nightmare for two guys kind of in the infancy of their England careers. And whilst I wouldn't have selected James Vince to bat at number three for England during the Ashes and in New Zealand, now that he has done and has kind of done okay doing it, then do you sort of throw away that investment by axing him at the beginning of this summer? Or you give him another couple of Test matches to see whether or not he's got what you want for the India series. So my feeling is that even though we've got a new a new man in charge, that the team will look very, very similar to the one that played that last Test match in New Zealand.
And that for me is the rub. It feels like settling for mediocrity at the moment where Test cricket's concerned. No one has made a real case for outright selection. I mean, David Milan was probably the pick of England's batsmen this winter.
Mm. He looks a fabulous player and somebody that I think could and should sort of be gunning for the number three berth as a permanent slot.
Technically, staying at four, you think?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Joe's the captain of the side. He's the best player in the side. As far as I'm concerned, he should bat where he wants. we've had this conversation before. Mm. Moving Joe up to number three just means you need to find a number four. So if he's happy at number four and he's scoring runs at number four, then he stays where he is. And I have no issues with that whatsoever. But Jack Leach, I think, will probably stay on the side. Moeen Ali, I don't think there's any way back in for him right now. And England can't rely on him as a bowler. The runs seem to have dried up a little bit. And whilst England get away with not having a specialist spin bowler at home, they've paid for it every time they've gone away for the last 3 years. So about time they sort of set their stall out to give a specialist spin bowler a run in the side. And so I've no reason why Jack shouldn't maintain that place. And then, you know, Ben Stokes, is he coming? He won't be back. Will he be back for the first test?
I think he should be back.
Yeah,
he'll be back for the first test.
He'll miss the IPL run-in, although I don't think his side will be involved.
They can theoretically sneak through if they win every game. But he still isn't 100% fit to bowl sort of a full sort of quota of overs in a test match, I don't think. That's the noise coming out of there. But other than that, I don't think there'll be too many surprises, and I don't think that no matter what Ed Smith sees in his or anybody else's crystal ball, that he'll be able to pull too many rabbits out of the hat in this one and solve any obvious deficiencies. And for that reason, I think they'll probably stick with largely the same team.
Miller, do you think the categories I've got here are where question marks exist, are batsman, third seamer and spinner, and Butch sort of covered a couple of those just then. Vince and Stoneman have perhaps benefited in this first part of the season by not too many of their competitors making an outstanding case. But then in the last week or so, Nick Gubbins made 100, Keaton Jennings made 100, Joe Clark's made 100, Rory Burns has made 100. It might be a case that England have picked the wrong Surrey opener.
maybe.
But, I mean, you're sort of the advocate for change in the room. Should one or more of those players be in the mix, if I mean, in the 12, in the 13, when Smith makes his announcement on next Tuesday?
I honestly think if you're going to go through the whole rigmarole of making a show of changing your selection process and upbraiding it for not being fit for purpose, essentially, it would be a bit weird to then bring in a new man, and particularly
to do exactly the same
as the old guy. I think there is, and Smith's a sharp enough fellow to realise that there will be an expectation that he does something. I mean, it's not necessarily doing it for show, but just to show that he is a new mind taking on an old job. And so I think they've got to think of something a bit more lateral. I like the notion of Burns and Gubbins are the two. Well, Gubbins in particular is a guy who was sort of mentioned in dispatches around the winter. Mm. I think going back to Keaton Jennings I'm not sure it's his time yet. His start to the season was pretty ropey before that 100. I think I'd just like to see just expand the footprint of possibilities. I mean, it's happened in the past. Obviously, the famous example being Driscothic and Vaughan, but you know there have been rabbits from the hat. In more recent times, I guess Milan to a degree was one, but you know you've got
Jonathan Trott was
a good example. Yeah. Exactly that. A guy who had a solid track record in county cricket, but yeah, okay, fine. Take your solid track record and see what we can do with it on the big stage.
I mean, one of the things, because obviously there's a lot of talk about data going on, and you know the likes of Jared and people that work for ESPN using their sort of that statistical. Base to sort of pick 2020 teams in IPLs and things like that. And looking at numbers and looking at sort of stats and success against certain types of bowler on certain types of pitches, etc. All of these things are absolutely valid. But one thing is 100% for sure, when you're changing things, a successful team absorbs change a damn sight easier than one that is losing. You know, but the irony of that is that a losing team will change more often than a winning team. Any unforced changes that occur in a winning side are often or forced changes that occur in a winning side are absorbed easily because everybody else is doing their job and it's no problem. And very often, as was the case with Jonathan Trott, a guy will come in and slot into a very, very good team and immediately find his feet. The difference is when you're changing, you're making changes, you're making slightly wild card changes into a side that is not performing particularly well. When everybody is struggling for form, it becomes even more difficult to assimilate these new guys into the team. Which is not a reason not to do it. I'm just saying, you know, that just there is a difference between making changes in a successful team and an unsuccessful one.
I think the one difference this summer, though, I think there is finally the penny has dropped that England are not a very good Test team. I think there was a sort of pretense wool pulled over eyes for several seasons, based largely on their ability to get out of jail in Ashes series on home soil. But I think finally people realise, okay, actually we're number five in the world and sinking. We're not very good. I think there would be a degree of leniency given to new guys, so long as the impression was that we're not just swilling around in mediocrity just for the sake of not rocking the boat. I think I'd rather see the boat rocked and some upsets, because let's face it, we are going to lose Test matches this summer, whether we stick or whether we twist. I would rather twist just to see if there's anyone out there who's going to help shore up the standards, rather than just rely on the same old names to produce the same old results.
I don't disagree with that, and I wouldn't disagree if Ed Smith did name two or three, different fellas for this first Test match squad. Except for the fact that England have been doing that for the last 2.5 years. This is not a team that is settled. These are not the same old names. The revolving door has been spinning pretty wildly for a long time now, and haven't been able to hit upon the answer. And so, yes, if you do make you know, for me, you'd make one change. You wouldn't change everything. You maybe bring one guy into the batting lineup. Whether that means, you know, Vince is the unlucky one, or Stoneman is the unlucky one. You change one guy, and you hope that guy beds into a team that starts to improve its performances. I think you go along the line of the old 90s line of you just change four or five names all at once. You know what you're going to get there. It ain't good.
The look in Butch's eyes here tells a thousand stories. I mean, if there's one sort of classically English, exciting start to the season bolter, it would be perhaps the third seamer. An interesting development this week, Mark Wood has gone home from the IPL to get some game time for Durham. He was obviously filling that role in Christchurch in England's last test. Toby Rowland-Jones, since we last spoke, has sadly gone down with another back injury. Chris Wokes is at the IPL, currently not playing. I mean, there are some contenders there, although some of them are familiar. Jake Ball has had a very good start to the season. Jamie Porter's done pretty much what he was doing last year. Ben Code is a...
All the people you'd expect to be doing well with, you know,
James
with
Harris,
the first week of April start are doing well. You know, they're putting it on a length and they're making it talk.
And a spinner that's come out as well, Amir Verdi. And that would be a real left field or a gamble for a guy that's played half a dozen first class matches.
Especially throw him in May. I think save him for August when
for
India
when India comes.
Yeah. but no, of those, I mean the one
looks really good, by the way. He does. He looks really good.
The one I'd like to see given another chance is Wood. I thought, you know, he went under-awarded, I thought, in Christchurch. Obviously, he got his maiden 50, which was notable. But I thought the way he attacked the game at crucial moments, he scalped wickets rather than just relying on conventional edges and tying people down and, you know, the sort of bore them out mentality that England took into the Ashes. He was bouncing them out. And I thought that even if he, you know, only got a couple of wickets, but they were good, aggressive wickets that blew the game open at crucial moments, exactly the sort of stuff that I would like to have seen him do from the outset at Brisbane if he'd been fit. So I'd like to see him rewarded for that intent. Obviously, you have to worry about his fitness, especially across 5 days, let alone T20 or ODIs, where obviously he's going to be crucial to England's World Cup prospects next year. But I'd like to see him rewarded for getting fit and showing the will to give it some, because England need quick bowlers and he looked the part to me.
I'm going to bring up an old chestnut just for fun.
Please do.
Ben Folkes has been scoring lots of runs for Surrey. You know, that top order issue is still an answer there, and it's right there in front of everybody. He's playing in the team and he's very good at batting. His name is Johnny Bairstow, and there is a way of getting him in the top five and have somebody else keep wicket. But there we go. I've said this before.
You make it sound so simple, Butcher. Has Ed Smith appointed his selectorial deputy yet? That's my question. Moving on to Pakistan, who obviously achieved a memorable two-all draw here a couple of years ago. But this is an intriguing, possibly a tricky tour for them, not only a potential banana skin in Ireland, but they return here without Misbah Ul-Haq, Yunus Khan, two of the sort of talismans of that team. We all remember the press-up celebrations in front of the pavilion at Lord's after they won there. And they're also missing Yasir Shah, the leg spinner, who's been so successful over the past couple of years. Sarfraz Ahmed has done sort of predictably unpredictable wonders with the white ball team, but the test team has suffered a bit of a slump.
Yeah, well, they were finished number one last time they were here, didn't they? After their two-all draw, they reached number one in the world.
They clinched it for about a fortnight.
Yeah, exactly. And now down number seven, which
the rise and fall.
Just goes to show. But
although England could have gone number one also at that time, so
that's true.
Rankings.
Yeah, rankings are amazing scenes. But no, I mean, It's classic Pakistan, really, isn't it? They snuck in under the radar. Everyone's watching the IPL. Their first game's washed out. No one's really given them the
soggy
time of the
Kent.
Day. And you know they're the type of side who will just pull something out of the hat.
They beat Northamptonshire quite convincingly.
Exactly. I'm convinced this series will be 1-1. We're going to win by an innings and we're going to lose by an innings. It feels exactly that sort of, we'll probably win the first test and think, oh, we've nailed it. We're finally back where we belong. Then we'll get spun out in the second test.
It's 2001 all over
2001
again.
All over again, exactly that. Hopefully good year for Butch. Front foot, no balls. But,
yes, it was a good year because I missed that series. I missed Pakistan.
In terms of the batting, Butch, I mean, for Pakistan, a lot resting on Azhara Ali and Asad Shafiq, you'd think.
Yeah.
Without Misbah and Yunus, so, you know, two pillars of that order.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, English conditions, not an enormous amount of experience of them in that squad. So, yeah, those two senior guys are really going to have to put some runs on the board. But again, you know, with Pakistan, because of the nature of the way that they play their test match cricket, you know, they tend not to have to score quite as many runs as other teams, you know. The bowling attack will make up for any sort of deficiencies in terms of volumes of runs. So, you know, on that score, you could pull the names out of a hat as to somebody that might be able to make the sort of contribution that will get them just enough to get their noses in front in a test match, and then they're very, very dangerous.
Shafiq got a massive 100 in the victory over Northants the other day, which was, you know, exactly the sort of innings, if you get one guy who can bed in and get enough guys around him, you end up with 350 on the board, and then with the bowling attack of Hassan Ali and Amir, etc., you've got, you're in the game, aren't you? Yeah. That is them to a T. I think, fortunately for them, I think, you know, that 2016 tour is recent enough memory for a lot of them to be able to slot back into that mindset, especially having had a proper build-up. You know, they've been here for 2 weeks already without even really noticing them, which, you know, they're acclimatised. They've had a bit of sun, a bit of rain. They've got pretty much a decent sight of every sort of condition they can be thrown at, and obviously got Ireland to come as well. So,
They will be ready, won't they?
Yeah, that's
very
more
unusual for a test team in this precisely. Day and age, but they will be ready. Yeah.
And, I mean, England-Pakistan clashes over the years have often been a sort of emotional, tempestuous affairs. Last time around, you had Amir returning to the game, of course. But there's actually been quite a good natured relationship between these two sides.
I genuinely think there has, yeah.
It's sort of turned around. And Mickey Arthur is sort of, well, apart from the slide down the rankings, has calmed the waters of Pakistan cricket, is it fair to say?
Yeah, I mean,
they won the Champions Trophy here last summer. They've got good memories of the place.
Exactly. You were talking about 2016. I mean, the last year's memories are just as applicable. It's a different form of the game, but, you know, they come back with a lot of good reasons to think we quite like it over here. Mm-hmm. But no, I'm excited by Pakistan every time they come over here. They're always, you know, it's a cliche to call them mercurial, but they bloody are. I mean, you never know what they're going to come up with, but it's rarely dull. And as you say, that good nature between the teams is extraordinary, really, given the history and obviously that incredibly recent history in 2010, what happened at Lords. All of that seems to have dissipated. I think I wouldn't say it's a underdog mentality, but I think the big clash of egos is going to come later in the summer when India come over here, and that's going to be spiteful and nasty, and I suspect there'll be all sorts of hissy fits and fisticuffs and all, you know, it's just that rivalry has really become something quite ugly, and as a consequence, I think, you know, the Pakistan-England rivalry is a sort of friendly game, isn't it?
Foolish man.
Well, speaking of rivalries and the mercury rising and so on, and perhaps friendly bonds being forged, a certain well-known cricketer, Mr. Virat Kohli, has signed up for a stint in the county game, which is obviously big news and exciting news for everyone. Signed for Surrey, he's going to play for a month, going to get ready for English conditions, and I'm sure he's forgotten all about 2014. But, Butch, can you exclusively reveal how good a signing that might be and how bad it may spell for bad news it may spell for England?
Well, it's an epic signing for Virat Kohli. It's a fabulous signing for Surrey County Cricket Club. It's an amazing signing for county cricket in general. I think he plays He plays, what, three or four Royal London games, one of them a day-nighter at the Oval. Plays at Beckenham, at Guildford, so sort of out cricket, festival cricket. Gets a huge, huge shot in the arm.
Four-day
championship game at Scarborough, providing that that's the plan rather than him playing in the T20 in Ireland. So that's absolutely incredible news. You know, at a time where ticket sales or getting people through the gates in county cricket can be a bit of a struggle, having somebody like that come over is unbelievable stuff. I go back to, I can't remember, it was 2015 or 2016. Surrey put on a game, Help for Heroes game, at the Oval in September, T20 match, kind of beer match, really, and hadn't sold very many tickets at all until they announced that MS Dhoni was coming. About 3 days before, 24,000 turned up. Wow. 24,000 people turned up. Piers Morgan was playing in this bloody game. It was nonsense. Right? So you understand, you know, so the Oval absolutely jammed to the rafters just because, you know, one of these great Indian legends come over. So I expect that to be, you know, they might even have to move the game from Guildford. Beckenham might, well, actually they can get more in at Beckenham than they can at Canterbury. But, you know, that's how big a news that is. In terms of, you know, for England wanting him to fail, wanting him to be in the worst possible form for the series, if I was playing, I might feel quite differently. But I'm not. And look, I think one thing that we desperately want is to have opposition, and people sort of have mentioned this for a very long time about Test match cricket, the opposition to be in as good a state to put up as big a fight as they possibly can when they go away from home. Otherwise, you have this endless procession of home wins, and the game just loses its edge or loses its competitiveness. So if this, you know, helps, if Virat Kohli ends up being in some sort of form and people can see this guy play the way that he can in five-day cricket over the course of the series, then I think it's not a bad thing at all.
Well, absolutely. And to go back to what I was saying about that England-India series, I mean, this is a statement of intent, the like of which I can't remember seeing from an overseas captain. He's missing out Afghanistan's inaugural test to prep himself for the big one in August. I mean, it is going to be a massive series. I'm looking forward to this in England-India series more than I've looked forward to any test series in the last, possibly the last decade, I would say. I think it's going to be that competitive because India are a good enough side to win over in England. England are a good enough side still in their own conditions to defend their hegemony in English conditions. It should be a tussle to remember. And it's made all the better by the fact that Kohli is willing to put himself out of his comfort zone by coming over here and acclimatising for an entire summer. It's great.
And there are a few India players over here doing that already. And Ishant Sharma's...
Pujara's getting knocked over left, right.
Well, Jay Pujara hasn't made too many runs yet, although he was involved in an extraordinary game at Chelmsford with Yorkshire, bowled out for 50 on the first before lunch on the first morning. And then... winning against the champions on day three.
Yeah,
it's all going off in the championship. Durham also winning after following on. Knott's top three wins from four. Mm. Exciting times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Virat Kohli is not going to know what hit him.
And on that note, I mean, it's clearly far too... Well, who knows? It's clearly Ed Smith has his own mind. But, you know, Harry Brooks' tale of redemption is a great one for... You know, here was
former England under 19 captain.
England under 19 captain, disciplined not so long ago for misdemeanours during the World Cup, and now he's come back and hit the ground running in his home season. It's almost as though that has just the pennies dropped with him of what it takes to succeed. So watch this space. It's a great calling card for a young batsman to come back from a little bit of ignominy in a global tournament and think, you know, this is my time. And obviously Butch watched him closer than I did during that tournament.
No, he can play. He can really play. So great that he gets the opportunity to be in the side to start with and that he's taken that opportunity by what must have been some fine batting along with England's number five, Johnny Bairstow.
But
done it again.
But the other classic part of that.
Although he was an opener, I think, for Priestley at Chelmsford.
The other classic part of that, obviously, another is Stephen Paterson. It's just once again dobbing his way to a sixer to seal the deal. I mean, here's classic.
Now that would be a surprise
selection. Classic yeoman in English conditions. But this is the type of guy. I mean, we're talking about the challenge that Kohli will face. You know, these sorts of bowlers achieving these sorts of feats in English conditions is, you know, it is kind of, it's not unique. It happens all over the world, and in New Zealand in particular, they're pretty handy with their Dibley Dobblers. But it is a challenge to overcome the yeoman English seamer, and
won't be if this weather keeps up. June, it'll be absolutely, there'll be roads everywhere.
Is he going to come up against, has anyone checked whether Darren Stevens will be bowling at throughout COVID?
He got taken out of the attack, didn't he, for dangerous delivery the other day?
I think he did, yeah.
Steve-o?
Slowish full tosses, are they?
Yeah, gets it down there, Steve-o, 76, 77.
Right, well, on the note of the immortal Darren Stevens, we've probably kissed the Blarney Stone for long enough today. Conveniently, come on you boys in green is a suitably neutral hashtag. Even if they're playing in white. So good luck to all involved in Malahide over the next week. And thanks to Butch and Miller, and to you for listening to the Switch It podcast on ESPNcricketinfo.com.